Graphic Audio, a movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents J.A. Johnstone's The Loner, narrated by Ken Jackson, with performances by Eric Messner, Michael Glenn, Bradley Smith, Joe Brack, Kimberly Gilbert, Christopher Graybill, James Lewis, Christopher Sheeran, David Coyne, Stephen Carpenter, Eva Wilhelm, Thomas Keegan, Elizabeth Jernigan, Drew Copus, Michael John Casey, Lily Beacon, Patrick Bussink, Richard Rowan, Joel David Santner, Terrence Aselford, Nanette Savard, and Mort Shelby. The Loner, Book 8, Trail of Blood. The men boarded the train at different stops as it rolled through West Texas. Three at Sweet Apple, four at Sierra Blanca, the final pair at Pecos. Each group gave no sign that they knew the others. Yet those who were familiar with the signs could tell the men were cut from the same cloth, whether they were acquainted or not. They had the same hard, watchful eyes, the same air of tension about them that was mindful of a coiled spring. Their hands never strayed far from the guns on their hips. Nearing the dawn of a new, modern century, fewer men packed iron than had 20 years earlier, and fewer still did so openly. Since the men were spread out on the train, no one really paid much attention to them despite the guns. That is, until one of the men in the second of two passenger cars stood up, balanced himself against the slight swaying and rocking of the coach, and reached up with his left hand to yank on the emergency cord. Passengers were flung forward in their seats. Some tumbled to the floor as the engineer up in the cab of the smoke-spewing locomotive threw on the brakes. The man who pulled the cord had braced himself for the jolt by grabbing the back of the bench seat beside him. He was still on his feet when he lifted the bandana around his neck up over the lower half of his face. He drew the Colt from its holster.
Nobody move! Do what you're told and nobody gets killed.
A male passenger, red-faced with anger, leaped up.
By God, you can't! Oh!
I said nobody move!
Is this a holdup?
Yes, ma'am, it sure is. So you might as well go ahead and fork over that fancy bracelet you're wearing, along with any other jewelry you got.
A similar scene was playing out in the first passenger car, although none of the passengers had been foolish enough to leave their seats and threaten the gunman who had taken over that car. The outlaws began collecting watches, wallets, jewelry, and anything else of value they could find. Up at the engine, two members of the gang had scrambled over the coal tender and invaded the cab as soon as the train jolted to a halt. They covered the engineer and the fireman to make sure the train didn't move again until they were gone. One man was in the caboose, keeping his gun on the conductor and the two brakemen. That left two men to loot the express car, and two more to take over the private car that had been added to the train between the express car and the caboose.
Who do you think this fancy rig belongs to? President of the line, maybe?
Well, who else would be rich enough to have his own railroad car? This is a real stroke of luck. I knew there was money in the express car, but I didn't figure on being able to grab somebody we can hold for ransom.
They made sure the bandana masks were secure over their faces. It wasn't their first train robbery, but so far, the law didn't have good descriptions of any of them. They boarded the trains at different places, they didn't bunch up so as to create suspicion, and when the time came to strike, they moved with practiced ease and efficiency. As they liked to congratulate themselves when they holed up in their hideout, celebrating their most recent holdup, old Jesse James didn't have anything on them. One of the outlaws threw open the door leading into the fancy car. Holding their guns tightly, thrust out in front of them, they charged into the car and found themselves in a sitting room with a thick rug on the floor, an overstuffed divan, several armchairs, a writing desk, and a hardwood bar. Everything was richly appointed, and the car itself was trimmed with gleaming brass. A door on the other end of the sitting room led into a short corridor with a sleeping compartment on either side. A man stood at the bar and smiled.
When the train made an unscheduled stop, I thought someone might be coming to call. Would you gentlemen care for a drink before we get on with the business at hand?
The man was tall and broad-shouldered. He wore an expensive but not ostentatious black suit with a dark gray vest and white shirt. Black boots and a string tie gave him a Western look. His sandy hair was longish, his tanned features rugged enough to be handsome but not pretty. He had to be rich, sure enough. He held a wide-belled glass in one hand, a bottle of cognac in the other. He cocked an eyebrow quizzically as he lifted both items and held them out toward the robbers as if offering them.
Now damn it, we don't want a drink. You're coming with us. I bet your family will pay plenty to get you back in one piece.
The man's easy smile went away as his face hardened.
You're going to kidnap me and hold me for ransom?
That's right, you fancy pants son of a bitch!
I don't like that. I've been kidnapped by outlaws before, and it wasn't a pleasant experience at all.
Stop flapping your jaw! You put that booze down and give us anything you got on you right now!
If you insist.
Before the outlaws could do anything, the man crossed his arms, sweeping aside the tails of his coat to grip the butts of the two short-barreled revolvers the garment had concealed. Faster than the eye could follow, he drew both weapons and fired.
That rug's going to have to be replaced. On the other hand, this new cross-draw rig worked very well.
The man holstered his left-hand gun, but kept the other gun in his right hand as he checked on the two outlaws, making sure they were dead.
You can come out now, Arturo. It's safe.
A slender, pale man in his 30s emerged from one of the sleeping compartments and stepped into the sitting room. He wore an expression of disapproval as he looked at the two corpses sprawled on the floor.
Really, sir? Was that completely necessary?
Yes, I think it was.
The man, known as Conrad Browning, took a couple of cartridges from the loops on his gun belt and replaced the rounds he had fired from the Colt Lightning still in his hand.
I'm certain these two didn't stop the train all by themselves. I think I'll go have a look for their friends.
Sir, are you sure you're sure?
Yes, I am.
The gang would have taken over the caboose, too, Conrad figured, so he might as well start there. He stepped around Arturo, leaving the nervous-looking valet in the car with the two dead outlaws. Conrad knew the man or men in the caboose probably heard the shots from the private car and would be alert for trouble. Conrad swung down from the private car's rear platform instead of stepping across to the caboose. He dropped lithely to the ground with one of the .38 Lightning double-action revolvers in his right hand. Crouching low, well below the level of the windows, he ran to the rear of the train. Silently, he climbed onto the caboose's rear. As Conrad listened, he heard one of the outlaws yelling at the conductor and the brakeman. He waited until he had a pretty good idea of where the man was standing, then wrapped his left hand around the doorknob and threw the door open. Instantly, Conrad's keen eyes took in the scene. The conductor was sitting at his desk, off to the left, and the two brakemen stood near him, their hands lifted in the air, as a single outlaw menaced them with a drawn six-gun. The man's head jerked toward the door where Conrad had made his unexpected entrance. The eyes above the bandana bulged in surprise. He tried to shift his aim and bring his gun to bear on the newcomer. Conrad was faster. The train robber crumpled to the floor.
Mr. Browning, how?
Is there just one of them?
Yeah, just one man came in here right after somebody pulled the emergency cord. I tried to get my gun out, but the bastard winged me.
He won't hurt anybody else. Do you know how many more of them there are?
No idea.
All right, stay here.
This is my train, dammit.
And I own a considerable amount of stock in this railroad, which means you work for me. You're wounded. Stay here. Gentlemen, see if you can patch up that arm for him.
Confident that his orders would be carried out, Conrad stepped onto the rear platform again. He checked along both sides of the train and didn't see anyone moving around. Filling his left hand with the other .38, he dropped to the ground and ran forward to the engine. Two masked men, carrying canvas bags, leaped from the open door of the express car. Before they could get their weapons out, Conrad put a slug in each of the robbers. Suddenly, a bullet kicked up dust in front of him.
Kill him!
Conrad ran toward the roadbed underneath the express car. He dove forward into the shade underneath the car, and rocks chewed into his hands and shredded his knees.
He's under the train! The bastard's under the train!
Conrad spotted a pair of boots running alongside the train. He aimed at them and fired. The man fell hard in an out-of-control sprawl as one of the bullets busted an ankle. He came to a stop, staring at the space underneath the express car. Conrad shot him between the eyes. Surging to his feet, Conrad sprinted for the locomotive.
He's aiming for the engine!
A man leaned out of the cab and drew a bead on it. Before Conrad could react, someone jumped the outlaw from behind, tackling him and knocking him out of the cab. Both men fell to the ground. Conrad knew from the clothes of the man who had pitched in to help that he was the fireman. The outlaw rolled over and swung his gun toward the fireman. Conrad got there first and launched a kick into the outlaw's head. The man's neck broke. Conrad holstered his left-hand gun and grabbed the fireman's arm to haul him to his feet.
Are you all right?
Yeah.
You know how many more of them there are?
At least two.
From the corner of his eye, Conrad spotted a cloud of dust boiling up a couple of hundred yards from the train. As it came closer, he realized the outlaws would have had at least one member of the gang bring their horses.
Get back in the cab. Tell the engineer to get the train moving again.
Open it up.
I want us rolling away from here before the rest of the gang shows up.
Sure thing, Mr. Brownie. Full throttle, Asa!
Conrad hurried along the tracks. The train was a relatively short string. A couple of freights, the two passengers, the baggage and express cars, Conrad's private car, and the caboose. By the time he reached the first passenger car, smoke was billowing from the locomotive's diamond-shaped stack, and the train was moving again. Conrad reached up for a grab iron and swung himself onto the steps, hoping the rolling train would take the gang members still alive by surprise, and they wouldn't have time to get back on board.
You settle down, or I'm gonna kill you!
Conrad could hear trouble inside the car. He paused on the platform long enough to thumb fresh rounds into both guns, then threw the door open and dived inside. Conrad slid to a stop on one knee with both guns leveled. At the far end of the car, one of the outlaws had an arm around the neck of a female passenger, dragging her backward as he held a gun pressed into her side. The other passengers in the car were hunkered on their seats, trying to stay out of the line of fire.
Stay back, mister! I'll blow a hole right through her!
If you do, you'll be dead a second later. You know that. You might as well drop the gun and save your life.
You could go to hell. You can't shoot me without hitting her.
That wasn't strictly true. Conrad could see enough of the man's face looking over the woman's shoulder that he thought he could put a bullet in the outlaw's eye. But it was chancy, and he couldn't guarantee the hostage wouldn't be hurt. He held his fire for the moment as the outlaw continued to back up with his hostage in tow until they reached the vestibule and were almost to the platform. Conrad glanced through the window to his left. Though much of the West Texas landscape was featureless, making it difficult to know exactly where they were, there were a few landmarks. One of them flashed past as he looked out the window. As a major stockholder in the line, Conrad had ridden the route a number of times, and he recognized the elevated water tank they had just passed. Normally, the train would have stopped there to take on water, but the engineer still had it barreling along the tracks. In less than a mile, the tracks angled sharply to go around a mesa. Knowing that, put an idea in Conrad's head.
Let the woman go. If you do, I give you my word you won't be killed.
What do you do? Send me to prison for 20 years? No thanks. I'd rather take a chance on a bullet.
If anything happens to that woman, it'll be a hang rope, not prison. I'll see to that.
Who in blazes are you, mister?
My name is Conrad Browning. I own this railroad.
Ha! That's a damn lie. You're a gambler or a gunfighter. Damn railroad tycoon could ever handle a gun like you.
It's true.
Stay back! Send word to the engine to stop this damn train so my pards with the horses can catch up.
Give up now while you've still got a chance.
I said go to hell!
The train hit the bend. The sudden lurch was violent enough it threw the outlaw on the platform off balance. His gun fell away from the hostage as he windmilled his arm in an attempt to keep from falling off the train. Conrad's right-hand gun snapped up and fired. His shot drilled the man's forearm and sent the gun flying away. The outlaw let go of the woman and stumbled backward. Conrad leaped forward, grabbed the woman, and practically threw her behind him. He reached for the wounded outlaw next, but he was too late. The man had staggered too close to the opening in the railing and toppled backward through it and wound up underneath the wheels. The wheels chopped him to pieces. Conrad looked at the woman.
Are there any more of them?
I don't know.
Conrad let her go, then walked into the second passenger car. It might not be over yet. But it was, Conrad discovered a moment later. He met the wounded conductor and the two brakemen coming forward through the second passenger car, and they reported the surviving pair of train robbers had been left behind, along with the other outlaws who had tried to rendezvous with them.
We got a Winchester back there in the caboose. I threw some lead at those varmints as the train was pulling away, but I don't know if I hit any of them or not.
It's all right if you didn't. You discouraged them from coming after us anyway.
Azza's got this thing flying. Somebody better get up to the engine and tell them it's all right to slow down.
We passed the water stop at Yucca Flats. Can we make it to Monahan's without taking on more water?
I'll check with the engineer, but I'm pretty sure we can. Especially if he slows down.
The conductor looked at Conrad and shook his head in awe.
I never saw anybody take on a whole gang of killers and nearly wipe them out. How'd you learn to shoot like that, Mr. Brannan?
It's a knack.
Huh. Maybe you better go talk to that butler fella who works for you and let him know you're all right. He was so worried about it, he was about to have a fit when he came through with your private car a minute ago.
Conrad pouched both irons in the cross-draw rig and smiled a little. Arturo was the high-strung sort, all right.
You're alive!
And relatively unharmed.
Conrad held up his gravel-scratched hands for Arturo to see. For a moment, he thought Arturo was going to hug him. But of course, that would have been much too great a breach of decorum. Instead, Arturo looked down at Conrad's knees.
Oh, you've ruined those trousers. In addition to getting blood all over the rug.
You knew you were going to work for a barbarous American when you took this job.
Yes, I did. But I didn't know you were going to wreak this much havoc before we even reach our destination.
Believe me, Arturo, I've just started wreaking havoc.
Why don't you allow me to tend to those cuts on your hand, sir? Then you can don clean raiment. I'm sure the train workers will come and dispose of the corpses you left in your wake.
Conrad relaxed and let the valet clean the minor damage to his hands. None of the scrapes were bad enough to require a bandage. Arturo was an Italian by birth, although he spoke perfect English. He had been educated not only in his homeland, but also in England. Coming from a long line of servants, at one time he had worked for a deadly enemy of the notorious gunfighter known as Kid Morgan, who was, in reality, Conrad Browning. A few years earlier, Conrad had been rich, successful, and happily married to a beautiful young woman named Rebel. His life had been close to perfect, but in nature, perfection is always short-lived. So it was with Conrad Browning. His wife had been murdered, his life turned upside down. Since it appeared he had died in a related outburst of violence, for a while, Conrad had allowed everyone to believe he was dead. During that time, he recuperated from his injuries and taught himself how to be a cold, ruthless killer. He came up with a new identity, Kid Morgan, taking the name from his famous gunfighter father, Frank Morgan, so Rebel's murderers wouldn't know Conrad Browning was actually alive and on their trail. One by one, Kid Morgan had tracked down the men he was after and had his vengeance on them. Eventually, the trail had led the kid to the person behind his wife's death, Pamela Tarleton, who had once been engaged to Conrad Browning. Her twisted nature had brought about her own accidental death, completing Kid Morgan's quest. That had left the kid facing a heartbreaking revelation. All the blood, all the death, had not brought Rebel back. The emptiness caused by her loss was still inside him. Knowing that he could not return to his life as Conrad Browning while he felt that way, he chose to remain Kid Morgan, a loner riding through the West, drifting in and out of an assortment of dangers. His essential nature, no matter what he called himself, would not allow him to turn his back on people in trouble. It was during one of those adventures that he had run up against Arturo's former employer, an Italian count willing to kill anyone in his way to get what he wanted. Tangling with Kid Morgan had not turned out well for the count, and Arturo had wound up without a job when Fortunato died in the New Mexico wasteland known as the Jornado del Muerto. By that time, the lawyers representing Conrad Browning's business interests knew he was still alive, as did his father, Frank Morgan. Having developed a liking for Arturo, the kid had sent him to San Francisco, where Conrad's lawyers had no trouble finding a job for him. He had remained in that position until recently. Kid Morgan had resumed drifting, until a case of mistaken identity had landed him in New Mexico's Hell Gate prison. Through a series of harrowing adventures, he had escaped and believed he had cleared his name. Being captured by ruthless bounty hunters proved him wrong. Again, he had escaped with his life, but in the process, the kid had discovered he had a shadowy enemy, pulling the strings behind the scenes to make his life a living hell. In order to deal with that threat, he had put aside his identity as Kid Morgan and fully resumed the mantle of Conrad Browning. Things had come full circle, in more ways than one. A showdown in Santa Fe had revealed the mastermind behind the kid's troubles to be Roger Tarleton, Pamela's cousin. The Tarleton family was still seeking vengeance on Conrad, and Pamela herself had reached out from the grave to drive one final knife into his heart. He didn't have to reread the letter from her that Roger Tarleton's lawyer had delivered to him. Every word of it was etched into his soul.
Conrad, if you're reading this, it means I'm dead. I'm entrusting this letter to my beloved cousin Roger with instructions that he should make certain that you receive it, should my efforts to avenge my father's life and my own honor go unrewarded. There is something I want you to know. As I'm sure you recall, you and I were intimate before our marriage, Conrad. Committing those words to paper should shame me deeply, but I am beyond shame. What you did not know is that when you broke our engagement, I was with child by you. Yes, Conrad, you are a father. Not once, but twice. I gave birth to twins, your children, not long after you married that other woman. They were healthy, happy infants, and now they are hidden away where you will never find them, somewhere in the vast frontier for which you deserted me. You are a father, Conrad, but you will never know your children, and they will never know you. And this is my final revenge on you.
That staggering discovery might have been more than some men could stand. But the man who was both Conrad Browning and Kid Morgan had been forged in a crucible of tragedy and grief. And though he was broken, that unholy fire had fused him together again, leaving him stronger than before. After reading that letter, he had allowed himself a moment of horror and sadness. And then he started making plans for how he would find his lost children. One thing was certain. Conrad would have to take up the trail first, not the kid. He knew better than to trust anything Pamela had written in that letter. She had indicated the twins were hidden away somewhere in the West, but that was likely not true. After he had broken their engagement, she had remained in Boston, where both of them had lived at the time. He was confident that was where she would have given birth to the children. So, that was where the trail would start. Conrad Browning was much better suited to dealing with the East than the kid was, so it was Conrad that had boarded a train in Santa Fe and set off on the journey that would take him back to Boston. He hadn't boarded the train alone, however. If he was going to fully assume the identity of Conrad Browning again, he needed a servant. Conrad wouldn't travel without a valet. That was what his friends and associates back East would expect. He'd thought of Arturo and sent him a telegram offering him the job. Arturo was more than happy to leave his current employer and accept the offer. True, Arturo was eccentric and set in his ways, but he was also loyal and intelligent, two qualities Conrad expected might come in handy before he found what he was looking for.
Ah, there. I think you'll be fine until the next time you attempt to exterminate every owl hoot and gunman west of the Mississippi. Of course, the coat is ruined, too. It's a good thing you are filthy rich, sir. Will you go through clothes? Trouble just lies in wait for you, doesn't it?
Seems that way. It was just a coincidence those men attempted to hold up the train we're on.
Coincidence, sir? Or the universe attempting to tell you something?
Like I'm jinxed?
I don't believe in superstition. But you must admit, it seems as if you can't go anywhere without someone shooting at you and trying to kill you.
Then I guess it's a good thing I can afford plenty of bullets, too.
Three days later, Conrad and Arturo disembarked from a train in Boston. Arturo fussed around, supervising the unloading of their baggage, while Conrad leaned on the silver-headed walking stick he carried at times. His leg had been injured while dealing with the threat of the bounty hunters in New Mexico, and every now and then it twinged a little. The exertion of stopping the train robbery in Texas had left it aching.
I have engaged a carriage for us and a wagon for our bags, sir. I just need to tell the drivers our destination.
Conrad nodded and gave him the address of the mansion on Beacon Hill. The big house had belonged to his mother, Vivian, and her husband. And later, Conrad and Rebel had begun their married life there before moving to Carson City, Nevada. Since then, the house had been closed up and vacant, dust settling on the covers over the furniture. Conrad wasn't looking forward to returning to his childhood home. It contained a lot of memories, memories he didn't necessarily want to stir up again. If it proved to be too much to deal with, he told himself, he could always pack up and move to one of the opulent hotels downtown. Conrad and Arturo stepped into the wagon.
Have you been to Boston before, Arturo?
Yes, sir, on several occasions with Count Fortunato. It's one of the more civilized cities here in America, isn't it?
I suppose so. Of course, I'm not as fond of civilization as I once was. I've gotten used to the frontier. Life out there is more honest, more open, more direct.
More dangerous and barbaric.
Depends on how you look at it, I suppose.
I must say, sir, you've changed a great deal since the first time I saw you. Back then, you were wearing that horrible fringed jacket and that big hat, carrying enough weapons to be a walking arsenal. Now, you appear to be a fine gentleman of culture and breeding.
But appearances are deceptive, huh?
That is not what I meant at all. But you must admit, sir, you are a rather complicated individual.
Most folks are when you get down to it.
Not I, sir. I am exactly who I appear to be.
Well, I suppose we need a few things in the world we can count on.
Conrad felt a twinge of apprehension when the carriage drew up in front of the mansion. It was a big house of red brick with a gabled roof, but it seemed to be some sort of monster, squatting there, waiting for him to come close enough so it could spring on him and devour him.
Wait, Arturo. Have the driver take us to a hotel instead.
Are you sure, sir? This is your family home.
The only family he had left was Frank Morgan, and Frank had nothing to do with that monstrosity of a house. Frank was somewhere out west, roaming the high country, or the deserts, or the forests. The twins, he reminded himself. He didn't know where they were, but it was a foregone conclusion they had never been at that house.
I'm certain. We'll be more comfortable in a hotel suite.
As you wish, sir.
A short time later, they were ensconced in the best suite in the most expensive and luxurious hotel in Boston.
As soon as we've unpacked, I want you to put on your secretary's hat, Arturo, and send notes to a list of people I'll give you, letting them know that I'm back in Boston. I expect that'll generate a number of invitations to dinner and whatever parties are being held in the near future.
But I don't have a secretary's hat, sir. Only my bowler.
It's just an expression. I'm surprised you haven't heard it before. Don't be so literal-minded, Arturo.
The mind is a literal thing, sir. At least mine is.
I'll keep that in mind.
Conrad dined that evening in the hotel dining room. He wanted to be seen. Many people from the upper crust of Boston society went there, not just guests in the hotel. The word would get around quickly that he was back in Boston, and the notes sent out by Arturo would make it clear he wanted to resume his former place as one of the city's elite. But as he ate the fine food and sipped the finer wine, surrounded by elegance, he compared it to meals of biscuits and bacon, washed down by a tin cup of Arbuckles, that he'd had in camps alongside many a lonely trail. And he knew he'd been happier on the trail than he was in the city. He hadn't realized how much he had changed over the past few years until he'd come back to Boston. That was where Pamela would have given birth to his children, he told himself. It was where the trail had to begin. There was no way of knowing where it would lead.
Conrad! Conrad Browning, is that really you?
Conrad turned with a smile and saw a well-dressed couple wearing expressions of surprise. He recognized them instantly, although it took him a second to recall their names.
Joseph! So good to see you again.
After he had shaken hands with the man, he hugged the woman, delicately, of course, because she was one of those elegant blondes who gave off an air of fragility.
And Celeste, as beautiful as ever, it's wonderful to see you both again.
What are you doing back in Boston?
Joseph Demarest's father owned one of Boston's oldest and most prestigious banks, and he was a vice president of the institution.
I thought you'd move west for good.
Joseph?
That's right.
Soberly, Joseph put a hand on Conrad's shoulder.
We were so sorry to hear about your loss, old man.
Such a terrible, terrible tragedy.
Thank you. It's been more than a year now, but the wound is still very fresh.
I'm sure it is.
You know, we heard this wild rumor that you... well, that you had passed away, too. Something about a fire at your house in Nevada, or wherever it was.
Carson City. Yes. I don't know how those rumors got started, but as you can see, they were false. I'm standing right here in front of you, as hale and hearty as ever.
Yes, I can see that.
Something in the way her pale blue eyes frankly appraised him reminded Conrad that on more than one occasion when he had lived there, Celeste Demarest had subtly let him know she might not be opposed to a little dalliance with him. Conrad had never pursued the matter, of course, because he'd been happily married to Rebel at the time, and she was plenty of woman for him. He had no interest in Celeste, except for the fact that she was a notorious gossip and would help spread the word that he was back. All the people Conrad had known in Boston had also known Pamela. The two of them had been a couple for several years and had been engaged for part of that time. Her father had been a wealthy man. Someone in their mutual circle of acquaintances would have seen Pamela following the end of their engagement. Someone would know something about the children she had borne. That was Conrad's hope, anyway. There were other ways of approaching the search, but he was going to start with his society friends.
What brings you back to Boston? Business?
Pleasure. I want to see everyone again and renew all my old acquaintances.
Oh, you'll have no trouble doing that. There's a round of parties and balls coming up. I'm sure once everyone knows you're back, you'll have more invitations than you can handle.
That sounds good. Can I count on you to act as my ambassador, Celeste?
Of course. Come to tea tomorrow and we'll discuss it.
An excellent idea. I'll be at the bank, of course, but I'm sure Celeste will entertain you and take good care of you.
I'll have to see what I can do.
Of course. Telephone me and let me know.
The Demarests went on their way, and Conrad resumed his seat. He smiled to himself as he swirled the brandy in the snifter. He completed the first move in what might prove to be a long game, but so far it was looking like a successful one. Despite that, despite all the elegance and comfort surrounding him, for a moment he wished he could hear the lonely hoot of an owl in the night and look up to see the western stars spread across the sky. The next morning, Conrad telephoned the Demarest house and informed one of the servants that he wouldn't be able to accept Mrs. Demarest's kind invitation to tea. He asked the woman to tender his regrets to Celeste and had just hung up the instrument when a knock sounded on the door of the suite's sitting room. He started to open it himself, but Arturo got there first.
I'm here to see Browning.
Mr. Browning may or may not be available. I shall have to tell him who is calling.
He's standing right there, and I can see he's not doing anything but drinking coffee.
Arturo waited, his posture indicating he wouldn't budge, though the visitor outweighed him by at least 100 pounds.
All right. Tell him Jack Mallory is here.
Very well. Sir, a Mr. Mallory to see you.
Send him in.
Please, come in.
With an impatient shake of his head, Mallory stepped into the room. He was tall and brawny, with heavy shoulders and long arms. He carried himself like a prize fighter, Conrad thought. His gray suit didn't fit him very well. Rusty stubble sprouted on a belligerent jaw despite the early hour. His rumpled thatch of hair was the same shade. He carried a hat in one big-knuckled hand.
I'm Conrad Browning. Would you like some coffee?
Sure. If you want to splash a little cognac in there, I wouldn't complain.
I'm afraid we don't have any cognac.
Black will be fine, then.
Conrad nodded to Arturo, who poured coffee from the pot on the sideboard into a fine china cup. Mallory took it, handling the cup with more deftness than Conrad would have expected from such a big, rough-looking man.
I'm told you're the best detective in Boston, Mr. Mallory. It's strange. I used to live here, and I don't recall ever hearing your name.
Not that strange. I've only been here about a year. If you've been gone longer than that, you never would have heard of me.
Where were you before that?
Down in Mexico, working for a mining company that was having trouble getting their ore shipments out. Before that, I was in Central America, seeing to it that a bunch of guerrillas didn't keep a railroad from getting built.
And before that?
Knocking around here and there. I worked for the Pinks, off and on.
But you're not a Pinkerton operative at the moment.
I have my own office.
You've spent time in some rough places. What made you decide to settle in Boston?
I never said I was settling here. There are parts of Boston where you can get killed quicker than in any Central American jungle.
I suppose that's true.
You sent word for me to come here and talk with you for a reason, Mr. Browning. Why don't you tell me what that reason is, and we'll see whether or not we can do business.
Of course. I want to hire you to find a woman.
Let me guess. You want to be reunited with some long-lost love.
Not hardly. This woman is dead. And if hate wasn't such a useless emotion, I think I would probably hate her with every fiber of my being.
That sounds a little more interesting. Why don't you tell me about it?
Conrad explained about his history with Pamela Tarleton and the posthumous letter he had received from her a couple of weeks earlier. He hated to open up and reveal his pain to the stranger, but if Mallory was going to help him, the detective had to know the background. The two of them had sat down while Conrad was talking.
What is it you want me to do, Mr. Browning?
I think it's quite likely Pamela gave birth to the children at some private hospital or sanitarium in this area. If she did, it's possible she might have shared some of the details of her plan with someone there, a doctor or a nurse, maybe. I want you to find out if that's true. But that's not all. To be completely honest with you, Mr. Mallory, I don't believe Pamela Tarleton was quite sane. She blamed me not only for ending our engagement, but also for her father's death.
It's none of my business, but did you have anything to do with that?
Clark Tarleton was killed by an assassin hired by one of his crooked business partners. Pamela never really accepted that. I suppose it was easier for her to blame me.
So she was loco. What's your point?
I've been going on the assumption that what Pamela said in the letter about the twins is true. Although I'm not fully convinced, she's hidden them somewhere on the frontier. It seems to me it would have been much easier for her to conceal them somewhere here in the East, where she's more accustomed to things. However, everything Pamela said has to be doubted on some level.
You don't know for sure there really are any twins.
That's right. It's possible the entire thing is nothing but a vicious hoax, intended to cause me more pain.
That would do it all right. Tell a man he has children he doesn't know about, send him on a wild goose chase looking for them, and then he's crushed when he finally finds out they don't exist.
Exactly. That's just the sort of warped cruelty that might have occurred to Pamela.
So you want me to find out where she had the kids, not just to help you locate them, but to prove that they actually exist?
Yes. Will you do it? Your fee and expenses will be no object.
I won't soak you. You strike me as a decent sort of gent, Browning. I'll do what I can to help you.
Thank you. I'll have my secretary write you a bank draft before you leave. Just tell Arturo how much you need.
What do you do in the meantime? You don't seem to me like a man who sits back and waits for somebody else to do all his work for him.
I have my own avenues of investigation to explore. Consider it a race, if you like, Mr. Mallory. A race for the truth.
One of those avenues of investigation opened up that afternoon. A messenger arrived at the hotel with a note for Conrad. When he broke the seal on it and unfolded it, the scent of expensive perfume rose from the paper.
This is an invitation to dinner tonight, Arturo, at Mrs. Beatrice Garrison's house. She apologizes for the lateness of the invitation, but says she only heard today that I'm back in Boston.
I am afraid the name means nothing to me, sir, although it clearly does to you.
The late Mr. Wilbur Garrison owned textile mills, a shipping line, and everything else he could get his fat, greedy hands on. When his heart gave out in his mistress's bed, his wife inherited everything and became one of the wealthiest women in the Northeast. She's a prominent figure in Boston society.
Ah, then I take it no one else knows about the amorous activities that cost her late husband his life.
On the contrary, practically everyone knows about them. But members of high society never allow the truth to interfere with their illusions. I know what I'm talking about because for a long time, I was the same way.
Having seen you in action, sir, I find that difficult to believe.
Believe it. There was a time when I was the most pompous, priggish, stuffed shirt you could ever hope to see. My mother, rest her soul, tried to help me grow up. But it took a couple of other people to finally accomplish that. It's short notice to get a tuxedo fitted and altered in time for dinner this evening, so we'd better get busy. The jacket is going to be especially tricky.
Why is that, sir?
It'll have to be cut so you can't see the guns.
When attending a dinner party in one of Boston's most elegant Beacon Hill mansions, most people wouldn't have felt the need to go armed with anything more than a gracious smile, a quick wit, and good manners. But Conrad felt naked when he wasn't packing iron. The alterations on the tuxedo had been hurried but expert. The price he'd paid ensured that. When he climbed out of the carriage in front of Mrs. Beatrice Garrison's house that evening, No one could tell he carried a .38 caliber revolver under each arm. The holsters had been removed from the cross-draw rig he'd worn during the train trip and attached to a special shoulder harness that was invisible under his clothes. Being armed like that wasn't particularly comfortable, but the weight of the guns was certainly reassuring. Conrad didn't expect any trouble at Mrs. Garrison's party, especially the kind that required hot lead, but he was ready just in case. A servant met him at the door and took his hat and walking stick. Conrad vaguely recognized the old butler.
So good to see you again, Mr. Browning. Welcome back to Boston.
Thank you, Charles. I trust that Mrs. Garrison is well.
Very well, sir. She and the guests who have already arrived are in the solarium. Do you remember your way?
Yes, I do. Thank you.
Conrad started along a richly carpeted hallway lined with sober portraits of generations of wealthy garrisons, thinking of the many dinners and balls he, his mother, and stepfather had attended at that house. The solarium was a high-ceilinged room with numerous tall windows. Boston wasn't blessed with the sunniest climate in the world. These people wouldn't know what hot sunlight was until they'd been through the Jornada del Muerto. During the day, the room took advantage of what sunlight there was, but the curtains had been drawn against the dark night. A servant handed Conrad a drink as soon as he stepped into the room. He sipped the champagne and moved toward the cluster of people around a short, stout, white-haired figure in a glittering dress and an abundance of brilliant jewelry.
Conrad Browning, dear boy, I thought you deserted us forever.
The beautifully dressed crowd parted to let Conrad through. He took the hand Mrs. Garrison extended to him, bent over it, and pressed his lips to the back.
How wonderful to see you again. We won't stand on ceremony. Come here and give your Aunt Beatrice a hug.
She wasn't really his aunt, of course, but she and his mother had been close friends. Conrad hugged her, being careful not to spill his drink, and kissed her rouged and powdered cheek. Her blue eyes sparkled as she looked up at him.
You should be ashamed of yourself.
Why?
Well, first of all, for taking that charming wife of yours and abandoning Boston in the first place.
Mrs. Garrison grew serious as she placed a beringed hand on Conrad's arm.
I was so sorry to hear about Rebel. She was very different from the sort of woman to whom we're accustomed around here. But I could tell she was very good for you, my boy. I liked her a great deal.
She liked you, too.
And you let all of us believe for the longest time that you were dead. Didn't it ever occur to you to let your old friends know you were alive?
I've been busy.
Well, now you're back. Hopefully for good. I won't monopolize your time. I'm sure everyone here wants to speak to you.
Conrad didn't tell her he wasn't planning to stay in Boston a minute longer than he had to, and spent the next half hour exchanging greetings, small talk, and pleasantries with the other guests, with all of whom he was acquainted. Joseph and Celeste Demarest were there.
I was so disappointed that you couldn't come to tea this afternoon, Conrad.
I had to get ready for this evening. Can't disappoint Mrs. Garrison, you know. And I was sure I'd see you and Joseph here.
Of course. Conrad, you and I really should have lunch sometime while you're here. I know you said you weren't in Boston to do business, but it never hurts to consider your options.
I'll think about it.
Conrad just smiled and chatted, and none of it meant a damn thing. The party was just an ordeal to be endured until he found out what he needed to know. No one had mentioned Pamela Tarleton or her father by the time everyone was called into the dining room. They had to be curious, but Conrad knew they were avoiding the subject, like they always avoided talking about anything unpleasant. He was willing to bide his time. After dinner, the guests moved into the ballroom for dancing. Conrad tried to plead a stiff leg, but Celeste Demarest dragged him onto the floor anyway.
You must be terribly lonely these days, Conrad. I don't mean to remind you of your loss, but I worry about you.
I try to keep myself busy. It helps not to think about things, you know.
Well, if you ever need someone to talk to, or simply a soft shoulder on which to rest your head for a while, you know where you can find me.
Indeed I do. Things have certainly changed in the past few years. 5 years ago, it would have been Pamela in my arms.
Pamela. Oh, that was a dreadful thing, you know.
Conrad thought she meant how Pamela had died from a gunman's bullet in a tiny New Mexico settlement. But then Celeste went on.
The way she shut herself up in her house was just tragic. She never saw anyone for months at a time. At least, no one in our circle. I assume she saw her servants.
She isolated herself?
Because she was too ashamed to show her face after... Oh, God, Conrad, don't get me wrong. No one blames you for breaking off the engagement. I don't know what actually happened. It was all shrouded in some sort of cloak of mystery. But I'm sure you had perfectly good reasons for doing what you did. Probably more than one reason. Pamela was always rather... rather...
It was a terrible time for all of us.
Oh, I'm sure it was. Such a shame. Such a shame.
So she never saw anyone?
Not that I'm aware of. And then after a year or so, she went away again. No one knew where. We heard later that she had been killed in some sort of accident out west somewhere. What a dreadful place to die.
Before either of them could say anything else, Joseph Demarest tapped Conrad on the shoulder.
Could I trouble you for my wife back?
Of course.
Conrad handed over Celeste, who didn't bother hiding her disappointment at having to dance with her husband. Conrad walked over to Mrs. Garrison, who was watching the dancers with a faint smile on her face.
A lovely evening, as always.
Thank you, dear boy. How are you holding up? The losses you've suffered? First your wife, and then Pamela.
Pamela was nothing to me.
The two of you were once engaged to be married.
That was a long time ago.
You would have been a good match.
I don't think so.
Oh, not as good as you and Rebel, of course, but still, it's a shame that things didn't work out.
I heard that she shut herself up in her house and stayed there for a year.
Indeed. I suppose she was in mourning for what she had lost when you broke your engagement to her.
With all due respect, Aunt Beatrice, I don't intend to explain myself.
I'm not asking you to. What happened between the two of you can remain between the two of you as far as I'm concerned. Anyway, it's obvious. You met Rebel, and that was the end for Pamela.
Do you know where she went when she left Boston after that?
I'm afraid not. There's a rumor she was killed.
It's true.
Oh, terrible shame. First Clark and then her. But these things happen, I suppose.
I'd like to know more about what she did during those days.
I thought you washed your hands of the poor girl.
That's true, but I'm curious. Do you think you could ask around for me?
You want me to be a gossip monger for you, is that it?
Not exactly. I'd just like to get everything straight in my mind at last, so I can put it all behind me and get on with the rest of my life.
I suppose I can understand that. I felt the same way when Wilbur passed on. Sometimes the knowledge is bitter, but it's better for us to go ahead and swallow it and be done with it.
That's true.
All right. I'll see what I can find out. I knew you must still be in pain when I heard that you couldn't bring yourself to go back to your mother's house and were staying in a hotel. I'll do what I can to help you, Conrad.
Thank you.
I warn you, though, sometimes when we look for the truth, we find out things we would have rather not known.
Conrad was a little surprised at how much relief he felt when he left the Garrison mansion later that evening. He paused before climbing into his carriage. The air was full of the various unpleasant odors of the city, but it wasn't as stifling as the hothouse atmosphere of stratified society inside the mansion. Someday, he thought, he would once again breathe in the clean, crisp air of the mountain desert country that had become his real home. But first, he had a job to do. The driver he had hired was a burly, middle-aged Irishman named Clancy. He turned around on the seat.
Where to, Mr. Brownin?
Back to the hotel, I suppose. Where else would I go?
Well, there's this little pub I know where you could indulge in some good Irish whiskey and a song or two.
You really think I'd leave a dinner party at a mansion such as this and go to some pub?
Begging your pardon, sir, but you strike me as a different sort of gent than most of these stuffed shirts.
And thank God for that. Sure, Clancy. The idea sounds like a good one to me.
After spending the evening with all those swells, it would be nice to be around some real people again, Conrad thought as he climbed into the carriage. To forget about everything for a while and just enjoy himself. Clancy got the team in motion and sent the carriage rolling through the cobblestone streets. Conrad leaned back against the comfortable cushioned seat. They left Beacon Hill behind for a more working-class neighborhood. The gas street lights were fewer and farther between, and as a result, there were some dark stretches of road. They were on one such stretch when several men on horseback suddenly rode up alongside the carriage. Conrad saw the dark shapes looming at the carriage windows. Instinct warned him, so he wasn't completely surprised when Clancy called out.
"There now, you scoundrels! Leave those horses alone!"
"Now shut up, you old man. I'll put a bullet in you. Now pull up, I tell you. Pull up!
Go to hell!"
"You first, old man."
Suddenly, the carriage slewed to the side. Conrad knew Clancy must have been wounded and dropped the reins. His hands went under the coat of his tuxedo and came out filled with the twin Colt Lightnings. As the carriage lurched to a halt, Conrad kicked the door open and leaped out. A couple of men in long coats and derby hats had grabbed the team's harness, one on either side, and forced the horses to stop against the curb. Two more riders dressed the same way brandished revolvers. The barrels swung toward Conrad.
"Drop them little guns, Fancy Dan. This is just a holdup. We don't want to kill you."
"Unlucky for you, I don't feel the same way."
Conrad tilted the barrels of the Lightnings up and blazed fire. In the dimness of the street, Conrad couldn't tell where he had hit them, but the cries of pain from both men told him his bullets had hit their marks. The last man thought better of continuing the debacle. He wheeled his horse around and kicked it into a gallop. Conrad started to send a slug after him, but stopped before he squeezed the trigger. If he missed, there was no telling where the bullet would wind up. Brownstones lined the street closely on both sides. A stray shot could hurt someone who didn't deserve it. The next instant, Conrad leaped aside as one of the men he had wounded tried to ride him down. The horse's body clipped Conrad's shoulder with enough force to send him spinning off his feet. He landed next to a carriage wheel. The two men fled on horseback in the other direction from their companion. Conrad held his fire as he stood up. The narrow streets of Boston were no place for a gunfight.
"A little help here, sir, if you don't mind."
Clancy was on top of a man who looked like he was out cold. As Conrad hurried toward them, he heard whistles shrilling in the distance.
"That's the police, isn't it? Someone reported those shots."
"Aye, that'd have been the coppers. Do you want to talk to them?"
"I'd just as soon we didn't."
"My thinking exactly. Should we leave this in here for them to find?"
An idea occurred to Conrad.
"No, let's put him in the carriage. I'd like to have a talk with him. Let me give you a hand. How bad are you hurt?"
"Oh, just nothing to worry about, sir. A mere scratch on my arm."
Conrad wasn't so sure about that. Clancy seemed to be having trouble using his left arm as together they lifted the unconscious man and piled him into the carriage.
"Can you handle the reins?"
"Aye."
"Do you know a place we can take this man where we won't be disturbed?"
"Aye, but just what did you have in mind? I won't be a party to cold-blooded murder."
"If I wanted him dead, he'd already be dead."
"Oh, I'm not doubting that."
"I just want to talk to him. Really."
"All right. Best keep them guns handy in case he wakes up while we're going. You're the first tuxedo-wearing gentleman I've hauled around who carries a couple of six guns. I don't know you, sir, but I got the feeling you ain't much like the other swells in Boston."
"Let's go. If you're sure you're all right."
"Aye. The coppers will be here in a minute."